The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day. Here is Derek Walker Smith, Conservative Member of Parliament for Hertford, to question two Labour Members of Parliament about their party's policy.
This is Derek Walker Smith, introducing this week's London Forum. The subject we are going to discuss is what is Labour Party policy in the light of the recently concluded Labour Party conference at Margate. We have in the studio Dick Crossman and Maurice Edelman. They are both Labour MPs and each represents part of the city of Coventry. The only difference is that, speaking very broadly, a Crossman represents rather the more left part of the Labour Party and Edelman rather more the right section. Do you agree very broadly with that description, Crossman?
Well, as I'm the chairman of the Keep Left group, I could hardly conceal that I'm on the left of the party.
And what about you, Edelman? You don't dislike my description of you, I hope.
No, you've put it rather crudely, but I think on the whole it will serve.
Shortly, I hope, rather than crudely. Well, now, coming on to the conference itself, I suppose you would both agree, and most commentators seem to take this view, that the conference really raised more questions than it answered, and that it hasn't really provided us with any clear signposts to the future action of your party. What do you say, Edelman?
Well, we've got to remember that this was the Jubilee Conference of the Labour Party, celebrating the 50 years of the party's existence. And so it was natural that at Margate we should tend rather to look back at the old pioneers and towards old inspirations.
That's but seem very far away.
The essence of those inspirations is that they remain modern. And what I think was the great achievement of this year's conference was that we've been able, through our new document, Labour and the New Society, to renew those inspirations by producing new ideas.
Well, Crossman, I see that you have said that the conference hadn't the haziest idea of the precise measures necessary to achieve a thoroughgoing socialist policy. I take it then that you don't accept Edelman's rather optimistic view of the results of the conference.
No, I would be inclined to be more critical. By the way, I think what I actually wrote was that the delegates on the floor who were demanding a more left-wing policy had the haziest idea of exactly what the left-wing policy would be. And that, I think, was certainly true. On that, I'd add just one thing to what Edelman said. I think our greatest difficulty today is our own success. The party has carried out practically everything which the present leadership, when it was preparing its policy before the war, dreamt of as socialism. They've carried out the obvious things they worked for and propaganded for 30 years. And there's obviously a difficult moment arrives when you've done all the things you thought of, and you've still then got to think out the second stage of socialism. Now, my feeling is that we didn't get very clear about the second stage. We were very clear about pride about the first. We were a bit hazy about the next step in socialism.
Well, I suppose you'd agree that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Can we look a little more individually at the main subjects that government has to consider to see how your party does stand in this Jubilee year? Now, can we start with the question of foreign policy and rearmament?
Good.
I suppose nothing is more vital or more urgent today. Would it be true to say that at this conference, the bulk of your party have unwillingly turned their back on the sophistries of the past, but are not really quite ready yet to shoulder the full responsibilities of the future? What do you say, Edelman?
Well, without accepting the phrase sophistries of the past, I think that as far as foreign policy is concerned, the Margate Conference demonstrated what has become apparent during the last 5 years, that the Labour Party is really a national party. And so it's not at all unnatural that the party should have a foreign policy which does command the support of the vast bulk of the country. If you meant when you spoke of sophistries, the fact that once upon a time the party was pacifist, I think one can say that we have certainly rid ourselves of our pacifist wing.
Oh, but well, just let me take you up on that. I see that 800,000 votes were cast against Bevin and the official policy on the foreign policy debate. How do you account for that? Was that the Crossman left-wing group, or who was it?
No, that wasn't. Matter of fact, our group was on the Korean affair, 101%, in a sense, behind the government. I should say that was the hangover, as Maurice Edelman was saying, of pre-war tradition. The party is traditionally, and I think very properly, hates war, but it was actively pacifist, anti-conscription. That was its tradition. Over the last 10 years, that tradition had to be transformed, and the 800,000 showed you what was left against the nearly 5 million who voted the other way.
Well, I suppose it's right, then, to say that this very considerable minority would regard themselves as the sole custodians of the true socialist faith from which the others have departed. Is that right?
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all. What I would say that these 800,000 were voting for was for the traditional belief in the party that the Russians, that Soviet Russia, the traditional heirs of the Russian Revolution, are in fact non-aggressive. And it's perfectly true to say, I think, that it's taken quite a long time for the idea to penetrate the Labour Party that there has been a counter-revolution in Russia and that today Russian communism is aggressive and expansive.
Well, I should go a little further than that. I should say that a large number of those votes were personal votes cast against Mr. Bevin, and that if the Prime Minister had spoken on that day, there might have been virtually no vote at all. Personalities count for as much in our party as in others, and Bevin is a highly controversial personality. Some people like him, a lot don't, and I think his personality made quite a difference to that vote.
Well, it's difficult, I think, to interpret the reasons for votes. There we have those figures, and just before we leave this part of the subject, you do agree, though, that people like Emery Hughes and Rhys Davies do represent something in your party which is as yet unconverted to this new movement of ideas.
Oh, I would say it's something very small and dwindling the whole time.
Well, now, may we come on to this important point. Should we not test the sincerity of your party's conversion to the necessity of rearmament by what are their practical proposals in regard to it?
Certainly.
And how far they accept its implications. Now, in particular, I see that your conference has saddled the cabinet with a promise of further aid to undeveloped countries at the same time as they are going to undertake more rearmament. Well, now, do you agree that both of those things represent a further burden on the production of capital equipment in this country?
On the retention of it here, you mean?
Yes.
Not on the production of it, because you could produce it and sell it and send it to the colonies. Do you mean on having it for British production?
Yes, and does it not, therefore, have a very considerable repercussion on the prospects of living standards over
certainly,
here?
Certainly.
Well, now, would you like to deal with that question rather more clearly than it seems to have been dealt with at the conference?
Well, let me start with three short observations. One, the socialists believe that you cannot defeat communism by purely military methods, that if you exclusively concentrated on rearmament and left all economic development of backward areas out, you'd lose the war before you started it.
Uh-huh.
That's number one.
Yes, well, I don't think they have a monopoly of
no,
that view.
I think we do.
Can accept that.
Right.
Yes.
Now, number two, they also realize, and I think this was a big change at this conference, that in the last resort, everything depends on persuading the Americans to allocate part of their resources to both these functions. That we can't, we've done a tremendous lot of both for the last 5 years on our own, and a lot will depend on how far America is prepared to help. And therefore, there was the unknown X at this conference of how much American assistance there would be. We can't tell what the sacrifices of this country have got to be till we know the amount of American assistance.
Well, then, may I put this point to you then at this stage, Crossman? is the position really this, that the conference has hoped that it will be so, but whether or not the cabinet can make it so depends not on socialism, but on exterior aid from the United States of America. Is that right?
The amount of sacrifice we shall have to have here, of course, depends on the amount of aid we shall get. Let me just put in the third point.
If you please.
We also believe that the increase of the productive capacity of this country, which has been going on at a 5% each year, and if that goes on at compound interest, you will be able to sustain far more burden than one would have thought possible 10 years ago, owing to that steady increase of the national production.
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you, before we leave that, Edelman, if I may, I just want to ask Crossman one question on what he has said. Is it then right to say that the Labour Party intend in any event to go on with this programme, but that they haven't yet been able to put before the people of this country the measure of sacrifice it will entail in living standards at home? Is that
right? I think
right?
It's perfectly fair to say that one cannot yet know, because of the unknown X of America and the unknown X of our production increase, how much we shall have to sacrifice. If the Americans come up to scratch, and if the British worker comes up to scratch, the sacrifice might be small.
All right, well, Edelman, are you prepared to go back to Coventry and tell them that they have got these sacrifices in store in order to help the undeveloped countries?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, what I'm going to say in Coventry tonight is that rearmament, material rearmament, civil defense, are two aspects of our general armament. And the third aspect is really our point four, and that is aid to underdeveloped countries. Because, as Crossman rightly pointed out, if the enemy is communism and communist power, then the only way in which we can win for ourselves millions of allies in Asia, where we have vital interests, is by giving them that aid. And therefore, I regard any help which we give to Asia as being an essential item of our own rearmament program.
Well, thank you, Edelman, but I think what your constituents will really be interested in is the ways and means. So may we pass then to another but allied aspect of this matter, which took up a good deal of time at Margate, quite properly. That is the reduction in the cost of living. Now, it's right to say, isn't it, that the delegates show place great emphasis on the necessity of a reduction of the cost of living, and that a motion about cost of living and profits was proposed and carried. What did you think about that motion, Edelman?
Well, what I thought about the motion, that it had certain internal contradictions. Obviously, it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to keep the cost of living down, and at the same time to pay for rearmament when the market is steadily rising against us. The real question at Margate was how we were going to distribute the burden which this country will undoubtedly have to bear in order to pay for the rising cost of arms. Now, in the past, one of our major slogans has been, as you well know, fair shares, and a very successful slogan because it was not only a political slogan, it corresponded with reality. Now, in the coming months and the coming year or so, our slogan, I'm sure, will be something like fair burdens. And I believe that if we do have fair burdens, we'll carry the country with us.
Would you say that the motion faced up to the realities, or would you say that it evaded every important issue?